Choose your issues.
Hello, Internet, and welcome to Choose Your Issues, the still not yet primetime ready podcast of the Objectivism Program at the Salem Center in the University of Texas. I'm Greg Salmieri. I'm a scholar at the Salem Center and teach philosophy here at the university. And with me is my very good friend, Gina Gorlin, now a clinical associate professor of psychology here at the University of Texas. We apologize for being a little late due to technical difficulties, but we're getting the kinks sorted out. I believe we are audible. If anyone on the internet can confirm that, that would be nice to hear. We have someone on the internet in the room with us confirming. and we are here to talk about a topic we've both thought and written a bit about in the past or spoken about, which is unconditional love. So there's the idea in objectivism, the philosophy that we both espouse, that love should be based on values and virtues that a person has, that love isn't a blank check, that it's not this unconditional thing granted to someone, but something that is a response to the person. And in Ayn Rand's novels, the desire for unconditional or unearned, as it's sometimes put, love is portrayed negatively. Think of the character of Jim Taggart, for example, in Atlas Shrugged, who wants to be loved not for anything he does or has or is, but just for himself, and there's no self there. And but there are things that, you know, it's natural to call unconditional love. There are types of strong experience that we both talked about in the past that seem like important parts of life that don't seem to be based on developed virtue, caring for people. And that's what we want to talk about today, these kinds of things that you might call unconditional love and how they relate to what's generally meant by the term and how we should understand them. So, Gina, you're one of the first. You've been talking about this for a long time in connection with some concepts in psychotherapy.
It's true. I think I first had occasion to develop my thinking on this idea of unconditional positive regard, which is a term in psychotherapy, when I was teaching a class on self-esteem and trying to survey some of the major views on self-esteem within the field. And it took me down a productive rabbit hole of really reading a lot of Carl Rogers. So Carl Rogers is a humanistic psychologist who famously developed what we now term humanistic psychotherapy, sometimes client-centered psychotherapy. And as far as I know, one of the originators or at least popularizers of this term, unconditional positive regard within psychology. And he meant by it something fairly specific. He meant by it a certain disposition that he as a therapist strives to hold, a certain set of attitudes and feelings, in effect, that he tries to hold toward his patients, and that he notices that when he's able to strike up those feelings and attitudes within himself, that therapy tends to go better. And he describes this at length, you know, that when he's able to love and to appreciate and to desire the fulfillment of his patient's needs, basically to like being in a room with the patient, unconditional upon the particular things that they might say, you know, whether their judgments agree with him or not, whether their particular behaviors are positive or negative, like when he likes them as the kind of fundamental beings that they are, that that opens them up to some sort of constructive change. And I think that there's something really profound about that, even though I wouldn't describe it quite in the way he does as unconditional positive regard. So I think something's being mispackaged there.
Well, the question is to why, if it's a mispackaging, it is. What's wrong or missing about it? And also what's right about it. But let's kind of get a catalog of types of things. So
sure.
In the case of Rogers, he's talking about an attitude he, as the therapist, adopts towards his clients. He has regard for them. Now, regard is a lot shy of love, right? But
true. It's a like. He sometimes calls it liking.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's not conditional upon their accomplishments, what they are, what's actually good about them.
Or at least not any of the particular list of virtues, yeah, that,
okay,
so you know, that he might be able to generate.
It's not conditional on what specifically good about them, or maybe about something good about them in a generalized way.
Yeah, or I think, and this is where I think he's not that articulate. Ultimately, I think it's a little hand wavy, but what he describes and what he demonstrates when he either role plays doing therapy or just lets us see kind of his actual process is there's a deeper, there's a liking for their authenticity, for their humanity, for their willingness to strive and to feel their feelings in front of him. Like and I think that there's something nameable there, even though I don't think he really names it that explicitly. That isn't nothing, uh-huh. like what might be Taggart's, you know, he wants to be loved for nothing. But that is general in the sense that it's something about whatever makes them fundamentally human and alive. And it's not, you know, any more specific accomplishment that they've already got to show for themselves.
Part of what's interesting about that, though, the way you phrased it, it seems in a way precisely conditional, or anyway, mm-hmm. it's based on something, namely they're showing up for the session, they're acting a certain way. It's sounding like there's a way the person could be in the session that Rogers then wouldn't feel.
Would have a harder time liking. Yeah, and he even talks about that. You know, he talks about, of course, I don't accomplish this all the time with everyone. I accomplish it under certain conditions, but he would never claim, you know, he'd never put that on the patients. But what he's really describing is, yeah, a certain way of showing up and a certain potentiality, even if he glimpses it. And it's enough for him to just glimpse it in moments, even if the rest of the time the patient's being really defensive and being, you know, BS-y and guarded and not showing up in that way.
So here it's sounding like, and I want to get back to giving a survey of different things, but sure. I'm just really being drawn into this Rogers case, which is interesting. That what he's saying is there's something in the client mm-hmm. that he has regard for.
Yeah.
And the regard for this is so strong or important that whenever it shows up, just a glimmer of it, just a little bit, is enough to sustain a kind of positive regard for the person. Mm-hmm. But it's not, it's for something that is in them, that is findable in them.
Yeah. But importantly, that he believes until proven otherwise, and I don't think he would, you know, I don't know that he would admit to ever encountering an exception to this rule. Yeah. He believes that, like, by default, human nature is such that he should expect to find this in the people who come through his door. And well, maybe helping to transition to your cataloging, this also is reminiscent of something Montessori says about children and about the, you know, the observant teacher who waits and watches for the first signs of concentration.
Right. And the child that isn't there yet.
Exactly. That's the quote I was thinking. Yeah.
Okay, so, but before going to children, who are, I think, the other really clear cases, the other one is also in therapy, I think, the concept in which it's come up with me in conversations with you and others about therapy, and at the Ayn Rand Society a few years ago, we were talking about a paper on integrity and trying to integrate oneself. This is a paper by Carrie and Biondi, and we were agreeing and disagreeing with some elements of it. But one of the topics that I recall came up a lot in the conversation there was what kind of a commitment to yourself do you have?
Yeah.
Even if you think you've been a bad person in some ways, does everybody have this? Is there a kind of fundamental commitment to yourself, to improving yourself, a care for yourself, et cetera, that everybody does have, should have, could have? What do we call this? Is this what self-esteem is? Is it not what self-esteem is? Is it something else?
I mean, I have lots of thoughts on this, because if we think about what it means to have a really selfish perspective on oneself, including on one's strengths and weaknesses and one's virtues and vices and on one's judgments of one's own behavior. Like, what does it mean to selfishly approach those judgments, to selfishly make those judgments? Like, what is the selfish part, right? So supposing that you find that you have been on a really bad path and that you've been, you know, self-deceiving a lot and you don't like your work and you don't like your relationships, and there's so much about your life that if you met you on the street, you wouldn't be friends with you, right? Like, and there are people definitely who come into therapy who speak this way, right? Like, I wouldn't want to be my friend. But the thing is that you have no choice but to be with you so long as you choose to be at all, right? Like that there's a kind of unconditionality in so far as you're still choosing to live. And choosing to live, we know, according to objectivism, it oughtn't be conditional upon any further ends. It's an end in itself. It is better than the nothing that is its alternative, so long as you have even, you know, the slightest chance at a glimmer of happiness and joy and you know, the kind of the chances to experience value in this world. And so that should be the only condition in a certain sense, as long as you still could imagine for yourself a life worth living. Whatever vices you discover within yourself, you know, whatever bad judgments you might make are fodder for self-improvement. They're fodder for, you know, it's still important to make those judgments, but not to decide whether to love yourself, rather to decide insofar as you love yourself enough to be worth fighting for, what do you want to do with those parts of yourself?
Yeah, I've always been a little ambivalent about these kind of formulations. It seems to me that what's relevant is loving the world or loving the life that's possible to you. But there is a kind of self,
who's self doing the loving
aspect of that, right? Of I'm loving the world. I'm loving the life that's possible to me. So it is possible to me, and I have to be the kind of thing to which it's possible. Like if you, I think there are people who should loathe themselves and should kill themselves. Adolf Hitler, I think, is one.
Sure.
I could name some who are less extreme than that.
James Taggart in our fictional
There are plenty of fictional universe, ones. I won't name anyone who will be controversial, but I think
oh dear.
we could all agree that
there are a few such characters history and
offed himself and no one said about it.
Right.
Right. But I think there's a way that you can be. We say, like, there's nothing to me that's any good. Like, the first thing I would have to do if I were going to try to make amends or try to get myself straight is, like, see that I deserve, you know, not to live for what I've done. But I think, you know, that is you've got to be, I don't think it's only Hitler, but like all the really extremes of bad people.
Yeah.
For that to apply. And
much, much more extreme than people tend to think about.
They write themselves off.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
So what you're thinking about is like, is there something that I can do with my life that I would find worthwhile, that I would enjoy, that I could understand as a good human life or a good segment of a human life for what's left of it. And if there is, it's because I have something, you know, something to offer the world and myself that I can then evaluate and love and appreciate.
And that's in a certain way a question distinct from judgment. I mean, it's a judgment. You know, in the broader sense of the term, like you're making an assessment of what is true and possible and what would be good. Mm-hmm. But it's not, in a way, it's like proto self-evaluative or maybe post self-evaluative. And that's that it's, you're judging, is there a life for me that would be worth living? And you can't escape the you as the beneficiary because that's who you're responsible for, and because, you know, in a certain way.
I think it's important that you're not the beneficiary exactly. You're the agent. So it's not like, is there some prize that it would be worth awarding to me if someone else were doing the awarding, right?
Exactly.
I mean, for granted, self-esteem is the conviction in your capability and worthiness of living and of happiness. But those go together, and they go together in that order, I think, right? Like, happiness is something you have to achieve for yourself, and to be capable of it is to be worthy of it.
Right.
So we've talked about two kind of psychotherapeutic aspects of it, of what we might call unconditional self-regard or unconditional self-love. We're going to decide whether we want to call it that, and we've seen reasons to think it's not that. But it's something that you want to contrast with a kind of conditionality in psychotherapy, the kind of regard Rogers recommends having towards one's clients as a therapist, and also an attitude that you need to have towards oneself in self-improvement, particularly in radical self-improvement.
Yeah, and again, I don't think it's conditional in any of the ways I've ever heard anyone use that term. All the ways I've ever heard anyone use that term are bad ways of holding this kind of love or regard conditionally, because it's too narrow and or second-handed and or just and derivative rather than fundamental, like to make your own self-love conditional upon how much you've accomplished by age 35. You know, that's how typically people do that.
Conditional versus unconditional is very feels very concrete bound to me. You're focusing on the particular things that can come out of it. It's
exactly.
It's sort of like there's this issue. Francis Bacon talks about groups of people, both of whom he thinks are mistaken, who think that knowledge is a value for its own sake rather than for its for what can be done with it, what can be made of it. On the one hand, think of that as a rationalist or objectivist, call an intrinsicist view of knowledge.
Yep.
And then on the other hand, the mechanics, who he doesn't like, who think of knowledge as valuable just for what you can make with it, where what you can make with it is some like little incremental thing. You're always trying to build a better mousetrap, and you think of, you know, well, we're going to come up with the laws of motion to do this, and you have these kind of particular concrete goals. And if you think of the people who think of knowledge as valuable for its own sake, it would be like the Robert Stadler kind of character in Atlas Shrugged.
Yeah.
But what's the other kind of character? Because you might think the alternative that is valuing knowledge for its practical applications. Sure, yeah, Galt does that.
But there's also a sense in which he venerates it.
Yeah.
Right.
And Stadler talks about him as just doing it in the course
of an engineer. Right. But people view engineers this way.
But there's a kind of, if you think, you know, splitting the atom is good because, you know, and you have some very trivial point by point list of 10 inventions that'll come from it.
Right.
You're kind something of missing something. The way Bacon thinks of it is, no, knowledge is empowering. It'll enable us to be like gods. There's a kind of metaphysical grand scale of what will come from it, not this or that or the other thing. And if you think of something as being conditional, like is the value of knowledge conditional on what you can get from it? That way of putting it puts you in the mind of like, I have eight things I'm going to get from it. I'm going to put them in checkboxes. Versus, you know, knowledge is valuable for its fruits or for the way it empowers you. It gives you a kind of more holistic perspective on it. There is an end that it's valuable for, but it's not.
But it's also, it exists together with and as part of that end and is continuous and gains its own value from the meaning attached to the pursuit of those ends. Yeah, and it's the same. I mean, so
Then there are two separate points here. One is the point I was making of you have to think of, if you're going to say its value depends on an end, you have to conceptualize the end abstractly enough and grandly enough to integrate the whole fullness of it and not see it as like a bunch of individual points. Instead of seeing it as a bundle of sticks, you have to see it as a tree.
Yeah. But to take this into the human context, maybe you're going there already.
Well, that's why I think you had gone a different place than I was thinking, but that I also think is right. The other side of it is that a point I've also made sometimes that knowledge is none of the concrete values that are valuable for human beings, even categories of value, are valuable in themselves in isolation from the rest. They're all valuable
as parts of the whole of a life.
The whole of a life.
And I think the humanistic perspective that Rogers is known for is capturing some part of that insight. I mean, he describes it as organismic development, organismic striving. He's one of the few scholars outside of objectivism whom I've seen routinely use the term organismic. And I think that's notable, you know, that he's really paying attention to human beings as whole organisms. And he understands their potentialities and their mistakes and their virtues and their errors as parts of that whole, which is, you know, this developing organism. And he sees the organism as, you know, capable of tremendous growth and flourishing and self-creation. I know it's more my term than his, but he says similar enough things. And so when he loves, you know, or at least positively regards a patient in therapy, he's regarding them, you know, he understands them as organisms.
What word would he use rather than self-creation?
That's a good question.
Development.
I have some quotes of
growth.
Self-development, self-actualization. You know, he's definitely on about self-actualization along with some of his, you know, contemporaries. I've got a bunch of quotes by him up here. But yeah, I mean, I think terms like I'm trying to think that there's a kind of like a fulfillment of potential. or at least that that's an emergent theme, whether or not those are exactly the words he uses.
The development angle brings us to the third case where, which I think is the most striking case of, I think there's something plausible about the idea of unconditional love, but I still don't think it's right. And I think it's important to see what the right way to conceptualize this case is. And that's love for children, and particularly love for one's own children. And the place where, I mean, I started thinking about this is when I was teaching at Le Shrugged in a course at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, years ago, when I taught there, and it was a course on human nature that I taught the book in. And we were thinking about human beings as rational animals and what that means and how their emotions fit with it, and talking about some of this material on love. And one thing we started talking a lot about with the students is, well, what about a parent's love for a child? That is that conditional? Is that based on what the child has made for himself? Surely not at the very beginning when he hasn't made anything of himself. And this was one of a few different topics, all related to procreation and parenting, that I discussed in my talk at the Objectivism Conference this summer. And part of what I said there, which is, I think, a key to all of these cases, is that what you're loving in loving a child is humanity as such, or the human potential in the person of a particular other. And I think that's really right, and it matters, but I think there's a lot more to be said about it than I was able to there and than I have worked out myself yet. And I think it's really interesting to think about how it relates to conditionality and unconditionality.
Yeah. Even in an adult context, because I think there's a lot we can learn from the child case about what we can love in ourselves and how we can relate to ourselves. You know, I did a self-parenting talk a couple of Ocons ago where I made that exact kind of analogy. But I think one thing just to notice, and for any parents listening, I think this may be more apparent, but really anyone who's been around a baby, like just how easy it is to love a baby. And it, like, it's not rocket science, right? And you think it might be harder to articulate what it is, you know, and there are BS evolutionary explanations and this and that, but.
Yes and no. It's easy to have positive regard for a baby.
Okay.
It's easy to like a baby, right? You have to be a really crummy person to bear a baby ill will as opposed to positive will. But what a parent does isn't just like, oh, that baby's nice, right? I mean,
it's more specific
than that.
We're here
with child now, and we each have young
children. I mean, I have to say, I don't per se feel strong love yet for the fetus growing in my tummy. Like, I think there's some, I'm sorry, okay, I've scandalized some of our audience members. Okay, I've just broken the law.
You might be against the law for saying that.
What have I done? No, but the point is that there is, in fact, it's even here, it's not strictly speaking, it's not causeless love. It is very much, you know, I mean, but when you watch a baby figuring out how to move and figuring out how to knock things over and how to make mobiles, you know, light up or flash, and just like the consternated effort that they put into figuring things out and to looking around at the world, I mean, it's glorious.
Yeah, but it's also like, really nice when it's someone else's kid over there and not yours, and you don't love everyone's kid.
No, right? Sure. There's it's getting to know this child and their developmental trajectory.
Is it getting to know, or what exactly is it? Someone might think that this connection between a parent and his or her specific kid is like the core thing of love. This is what it evolved for. This is what it's about. What we feel for our partners, or what we feel for people in our, is an extension of this. Here's the paradigm case of love.
Right.
Any theory of love's got to start from this and step out. I don't think that, but whether that's true or not, like, it is a striking thing that, it's easy to think, you know, oh, how cute, but not like I'm going to devote my life to making this one of the many cute things out there. You know, to help raising them, I'm going to spend so much time on it. There's a kind of, you know, commitment that a parent has to a specific child.
But there's also what you know you're going to put into this value, right? So the love is clearly also, if you will, conditioned upon the investment that you plan to make in forming a very particular kind of relationship that reflects you as much as it reflects the child, and in how does Karen put it, teaching them your ways or passing on your your special procedures. This is
my wife many years ago when we first, you know, were contemplating having kids, saying someone to pass on my ways to.
Yes. I view it a bit differently, but that is one of the kinds of things you might be excited for.
If
you just immunizing it against my ways.
Anyway, I see.
Putting them on a better trajectory than what, you know, you always want your kid to be better off than you were, right? It's like each next generation. Anyway, go ahead.
So yeah, the thing that I'm interested in here is the, and what I think of it as like loving humanity in the person of a particular child, is it's a one-on-one particular emotional investment. I think it is an investment in a individual child.
Yeah.
That it's this one, I've born it, or, you know, fathered it,
absolutely,
or adopted it, or it, him or her, you know, whatever. And this is mine, right?
Yeah. As for any value that you choose to cultivate and invest in.
Right.
And love.
There's a kind of, I think the fact that there's something non-rescindable and non-negotiable about it, and it's a real commitment, matters to what you're doing in having a kid. Like, you could say, like, I'm going to buy this house and I expect to like it. It's this house and whatever.
Right.
But if it doesn't work out, I'll sell it and get another one.
Yeah, that doesn't work with
kids. You can't do that with children. But I think part of what that is that what you're doing in having a child, whether you have it in the normal biological way or by adopting it, is you're saying,
I'm investing in this form of the human potential, or this instantiation of the human potential.
Like, but what, like, I love humanity and what human beings can be. And
I want to raise one.
That I want to raise one and be with one through all of it.
Yeah.
Through the ups and downs, through all the chance. Like, if humanity is good and it's good, warts and all, and it's good, problems and all, and it's good through thick and through thin or whatever, I don't know which one I'm going to get. I don't know what it's going to be like. I don't know what disabilities, challenges, mistakes, et cetera, it's going to have. But because human beings are good, you know, I want a human being through thick and through thin.
Yeah, and so your love of your baby is as, again, not exactly unconditional, as fundamental as your love of humanity.
Right, but that's what I mean by it's like the fact that you're picking a particular, you're connecting to a particular one.
Yeah.
Without knowing where he's going to fall on all of these things and how it's going
to
go.
It's a commitment to your love of humanity and an expression of your love of
humanity.
And
the not picking by detail, so to speak, is
– as long as it's green-eyed and bushy-tailed.
the not picking by condition, right, is part of what it is to be committing to humanity. I mean, you have hopes and you might, you know, whatever. But the idea is come what may, or come the range of possibilities, right?
Yeah.
But then there was something else about this that's, I think, interesting. Like, that description sounds perfectly fine for a fetus. Like, you know, what you're expecting, why you've chosen to carry this fetus, and what you want to have with it when it comes out. It, like, doesn't strike me as plausible of Alice or of Alan yet. That is our children who are, you know, 2.5 and 3.
You mean yet or anymore?
Anymore.
Okay, just checking.
Right.
Right.
But neither is it like, oh, she's made of herself a fine woman.
No, and this is what I meant about, so you fall in love with your child.
But I want to think about what that means, given that it's
given that I was going to fall in love with my child no matter who she turned out to be, more or less.
Yeah, and given that both of these things are elements of it, it's continuous with and based on this thing we were talking about.
Yep.
And
but that's,
how does it relate to love as we think of it among adults, where it's based on who they are?
I mean, just as you don't love humanity in the abstract, even though it is humanity as such that you love it in all of its particulars. You love the particular members of it who exemplify it for you. You love the experiences that you have had with the best of the humans that you've both met or, you know, encountered in fiction or literature, whatever. So you don't love your child in the abstract. You love them as the particular manifestation of humanity that they are becoming. And I think it immediately takes that form. Like, I don't think it's real love if it's, you know, detached from particulars. And that's why I say, like, I don't have especially strong love for the fetus yet, because I don't know much about, you know, like, I feel I'm dancing around, which is cool.
So let's think about what that means. There's what you're attending to in the child as you're falling in love with them, mm-hmm. as you're experiencing the love with them. And then there's also, and that's going to be something general.
Mm-hmm. What you're attending to is going to be general?
At first, in other words, think of the things you said before. As the child is struggling to learn, and as it's looking about, and as it's doing this.
And as it's cuddling like, up into you, and mm-hmm. as it's, you know, cooing.
You're picking the things that are like to do with growth, development, yeah. loving the world, reaching out towards the world, etc. And then as it does each of these things, there are going to be, you know, the many individuating
characteristics,
notes,
features, that emerge.
Details that, yeah, that
like
will
loving turtles
eventually like. Become mm-hmm. part of the particular personality
yeah.
or whatever. So I'll give you an example with Alan. This is my son, Alan. Like from very young, you know, different babies have more or less control of different muscles, right? But he had a surprising degree of head control,
oh, yes.
and looking around would have this kind of neck chucking out in one position or other. And so, like, that's a form of, you know, being interested in the world and wanting to see it. But
like,
it, like
a very particular
it has
form
this
that was
very
his.
Assertive form with him.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, whether it's a narrative one constructs or whatever, feels like the beginning of a personality and
yeah.
in
a very imperious one.
I spoke of him even as an infant as like surveying his domain, which
sure enough has only continued to, yes.
Although maybe it's our saying that brought that out in him.
That
but
happens.
Anyway, the point is that you are part of what bonding with the child is, I think, and mm-hmm. falling in love with him or her is noticing things about him or her
that individuate that
well, but
him,
both
her.
That are
yeah
that are but, consonant yes. with what you love about humanity in general,
mm-hmm.
and then like when you fall in love with an adult person, you know you don't fall in love with them for bad things
right.
you don't like. You love something about her or him that you could have described before you met her in a positive way, but not her way of doing it. Like, oh, mm-hmm. I like people with a good sense of humor. And when she tells a joke, there's something about the way her eyes crinkle up or whatever that then becomes mm-hmm. the concrete that you're, you know. But there's some, you know, general heading under which it falls, which you already liked. And mm-hmm. it now has this greater reality in the concrete. And I think that's similar to what happens
mm-hmm.
with the child. It requires a particular personality, particular individuating marks, but you're noticing the things that are like part of what you like about human beings that they do. And
yeah,
you know,
it's a real life concretization, you know, and dramatization, if you will, of, yeah, of striving or of benevolence or of playfulness or of diligence or you name it.
Now, neither of us have the experience of older children yet.
No, at least not on our own.
Not as
Correct.
Ours.
Yes.
But, I mean, we've been them.
True. Arguably.
And I do think parent-child relationships when the children age are hard and ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
There should be
Indeed.
This individuating on the part of the child. But
and a negotiating of, yeah.
Yeah, but I think also part of it is the parent is always going to have this special
vantage point and perspective on the child that they can't expect the yeah. child to have in return.
But also a generalized and hopeful perspective on the
yeah.
child that there's work, I would think, to merge it into a view of what the person becomes. I mean, we
yeah.
talk about it as It happens naturally in the early stages of you fall in love with this particular person. Mm-hmm. But even there, there's the question of like how much of what I think of as my son's personality is what I'm projecting on it,
sure,
versus what it actually is. And when he's 30, you know, that'll be a much bigger issue.
Yes.
Or 17.
Indeed.
So let's see. We've been talking about love in these different categories of love and how we think they work. So what about conditionality? In what sense are these conditional? We don't think conditional is the exact right word.
Or contingent. I sometimes like that. There's some way of more precisely capturing what's wrong, or instrumental, or I mean, you were getting at it. Yeah. I think with the Bacon dichotomy.
Let me give another characterization that's sort of meaningful to me. I thought of this. I don't know, way back when I was in high school or early college. This idea that there's such a thing as loving someone on credit and you shouldn't do it.
Ah, yes.
And think about more stereotypically, this is a woman for a guy. He's a fixer-upper and I love him for what he could be. And I'll introduce you to my friends when you're ready, when he's ready. I guess that was a line from Coupling. But
that's where you get your formulations. I forget sometimes you get them all from TV shows.
Not the love on credit.
Frasier or Coupling.
I don't know where that came from or if I just came up with it, but that particular joke is from Coupling. But
probably from Frasier then. That's right. Greg gets everything. This is where I'm going to make my big reveal. Everything you think is Greg's original formulation actually comes from one of two or three TV shows.
Just from psychology?
Okay, just mainly on the topic.
Psychology is the Frasier stuff. Frasier
fine. Was formulated everything psychological that Greg has to say for himself. Anyway. So love on credit.
See, what are people talking about? They're just talking about echo and audio quality stuff. So that feels like it's conditional. I have a view of what you're going to become. I'm kind of loving you with a down payment.
Yeah, waiting to see if you pass the test, in effect.
And I think that I've always thought that's really kind of destructive and weird
never
and not
works.
Real love and not real affection for somebody. It's got to be based on sort of what they already are. People are now commenting on the mic. So we are using dynamic mics. Part of the reason why we're doing it is we're in a live room, and I don't think it works well to use other kinds of mics. But
I have no comment.
But right now we have a problem with a driver where the person monitoring our audio can't hear us live. So what should happen is they should be ridden and set at the level where they can be a bit far back and we don't have to talk directly into them. 58 work decently like that. But given that we're flying deaf now, we may have to bring them a little bit closer. Anyway, this is part of the not ready for prime time business of this podcast. Afterwards, we'll put
pretty close to what would be prime time.
Afterwards, we'll put a compressor on them before we release it properly. But okay, I'm bringing
and cut out this entire little aside.
No, this is part of the fun of getting here. Okay.
Lovable quirks that
quirks
make
of the production
podcast
that,
complete.
You see us striving.
Indeed.
For a competence we haven't yet reached.
And you love us for
individuated
warts and
features of how we do it.
Yes, audio issues and all.
As opposed to just liking it if it sounds good.
Indeed.
Conditionally. And like a mercenary.
Exactly.
Don't the publicans.
Mercenary love. That's the
don't
term.
Don't the publicans
the
do
thing.
The same?
The publicans? Is that short for Republicans these days?
No, it's the tax collectors. It's from the Sermon on the Mount. What good are you if you only love those who love you?
I see.
The model of what I think is the unhealthy kind of
view of unconditional love. I see.
So I want to say for people in the room and for people online, we're happy to be shaped somewhat in where we go from what you guys have to say. There's a mic here for people who want to come up and have your audio quality critiqued.
Well, when you put it that way, the world. Extra enticing.
I would hope.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see, where was I going? The kind of love on credit is one thing. The feeling like someone's trying to put you into a box. You want to feel like, I think, seen and loved for what you are, right? I mean, I think that's what love is. And what is it to do that with a child? Well, the child is mostly potentials now.
Right.
But he's mostly potentials that he is, actualizing in the early stages. And to love him is I think to see that and
to love the current work and the current activity whereby the child is developing his or her capacities.
So could you talk about the therapeutic patient in that context?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's largely what Rogers had in mind and what I do as a therapist when I relate to someone who is, I mean, an analogy within the objectivist literature here, and I'll be curious to see what you say about it, because usually you don't like it when I try to invoke fictional characters as examples of things, but I have you here to censor me now, so we'll see. But I've always found it striking, the relationship between Rourke and Wynand, and the ways in which Rourke has no difficulty in loving Wynand. I mean, he loves him, right? And I don't think he loves him on credit. I don't think it's conditional upon Wynand, you know, turning a new leaf and saving the Wynand papers. I think he loves him precisely for what he is, who he is, and for, above all, kind of the visibility he provides to Rourke, which is unique among perhaps people he's met.
That part, last part's the one thing I disagree with.
That's interesting. How would you put it?
I think he loves it. I don't think love is about wanting visibility.
No, I that's true. You don't think that.
Seeing the other person. I mean, the other.
So the visibility Rourke provides to him, for that matter. But I think visibility in the sense of he sees in Wynand something that is intimately him.
Yeah.
And that he doesn't see in anybody else.
Right. What I don't like about the visibility provides angle is the idea that, like, I love you because you could see me for what I am.
Rourke doesn't care about that.
Right. I mean, I like, that's a very nice thing when it happens, and it is normally part of love, and it's a good.
He loves that Wynand exists in the world. Right. But part of that is he wants to spend time with him.
Right.
He wants to go places with him. He wants to do nice things for him and to be friends with him. He wants to see him in the world. He doesn't just want to know in some abstract way that he exists, right?
He wants to experience him because of what he is and because of what he sees him.
But that's, I guess, that's what I mean by visibility. Like, he provides a dramatization of Rourke's mode of existence in a really unique way that nobody else seems to. And I think the fact that they understand each other on the level that they do is part of that. Like the fact that they connect over the kinds of moments and the punctuation of their lives by these moments and what they, the ways that they experienced their own.
Yeah. I mean, I think Rourke sees what's good about Wynand.
Right.
In a way that nobody else does.
Including Wynand. Right.
Although interestingly here, notice Rourke's formulation of what he loves about Wynand or what's good about him, which is that he wasn't born to be a second hand.
Yeah. And so now, it's a potentiality.
Right.
But it's a potentiality, A, that's kind of stillborn. Mm-hmm. And he knows that even as he says it. And it's tragic. And he hopes that Wynand won't kind of put that together, right? Even as he says it. But B, it's he loves Wynand as he is today because he's such a man, because he's a man who wasn't born to be a secondhander. So if we think about.
And now the born to be, we should say, is a kind of metaphor.
Right. It's not obviously
literally
that's
how
not,
he was born. And there's a bunch of stuff about her working, Rand working out her
views on this.
But it's not. But however you take it, it's not just whether through birth or through what he did as a young child or whatever, that he acquired it, that he has this potential to not be a second-hander.
No, it's because of how today he sees things.
He is a certain way.
Yeah, he sees things, he understands things.
He shouldn't be a second-hander.
Exactly.
Namely, he has the kind of mind that values and cares about things and understands things and acts for itself. He has the kind of core of
the kind of way of
facing existence Rourke has.
Yeah.
But he also has something that's kind of
overlaid
betraying,
on that,
undercutting
which is
that, and so making him function as the kind of person who didn't have that core.
Right. But for Rourke, that's less important
than that he
to
has
him
it.
Qua friend, right? Qua kind of providing the kind of deep spiritual value that he provides to Rourke. And I think that that's notable when thinking about, for example, you know, how I relate to a patient who often won't value him or herself the way that I'm able to value them, because they're seeing all the contingencies wherein like they're not fulfilling their potential, or they're not living the life that they once envisioned, or they have failed to even envision for themselves, you know, a career or a relationship that's on their own terms, and they've kind of stumbled into a life that just is conventional or isn't theirs. Whereas what I see in them is the ambitiousness of that vision and of that, or even the longing and of the, you know, the way in which they're frustrated. What's writ large there for me is that they want more, and that they're here actively struggling and, you know, fueling the embarrassment and the pain and the shame and for the sake of the possibility of that more. And in the particular way that they're doing it, right? Because every client is different and is very particular, as we were saying about children.
There's a skill of prospecting for the lovable in people, in yourself and in others.
And yes, and that's a big part of, I think, doing therapy or coaching or parenting or teaching, right? In any role like that, I think to be able to prospect for it and then to be able to model it back to the individual, you know, person themselves so that they can start to see themselves from that kind of vantage point.
But then what is it that we're seeing and reflecting back? If it's not unconditional love, and I grant that it's not love in all cases because it's sometimes it's just liking or self or regard. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, I mean, I think there are a few formulations we can at least grapple at, right? Like it's love for the best within them as it exists today. It's love for the growth itself and for the striving itself and for the spark itself, which is itself then going to be the catalyst for all kinds of more particular value pursuits and, you know, particular virtue development that then will make it more fun to be them on a day-to-day basis. But that I can see that I can love the faculty that generates those kinds of values. And I think that that has to do with when we were talking about the kind of actualization of the potential we see in our children, even as it's still in its very early days.
Yeah. And it's, that's right. It's, I like the phrase love for the best within them. And that needn't be, but can be, love for someone on the basis of the best within them.
You mean love for the whole person as opposed to, And I think part of what's happening in these cases is there's a fundamentality to it. It's like, it's a metaphysics. It's like applying a metaphysics where the important things about someone are not their flaws and their errors and their, even their vices. Like what's important is that there's a life being lived, that there's a spark of, you know, of humanity, of, you know, with all that that implies and can contain within it, like, and anything that flows from that and expresses that, like, that's what's fundamental.
And in some cases where you might say there's not yet a life being lived, what's more important is that there's the possibility of that. And the things that, if you think of them as little sparks that might get together to kindle a whole fire, but right
and
now
they're loving that
little crackles.
Yeah.
Yes, I think this point about what's important really matters. And I think that it's also context relevant to who you are relative to the person you're talking about.
Yes.
If you are you, if this is you that you're talking about, what could be more important
than capacity for a life?
Yeah, than your capacity living, for a life. You're not looking at yourself third person on.
Right.
And like, well, and you know, this guy I don't really want to hang out with, but that guy I will, because he's you know, got his life roaring and raging and so forth, and he's just some embers that might reignite. Like you can't be that to yourself. You're with you, so you're not kind of playing the odds of who's going to be best or whatever.
Yeah, and I think that what Rogers was observing was that people often by default relate to themselves as if third person.
As if third person.
So in that unhelpful way. Yeah, an unselfish way, I would argue.
Why, this is going to sound dumb, but like, why should you relate to yourself first personally rather than third personally? And I think there are two reasons. I mean, one is the reason you gave that you're stuck with you, you know, you can't go find another you to be friends with. But I think the more important one, because then maybe you should just give up, you know, maybe you suck and that's it, you know. But I think the more important one is that you are you, not you're stuck with you, but in particular, you're in control of you. You have free will. You have choices.
Yeah, you have a power that no one else has with respect to you.
Whether the best in you comes forward, gets engaged, whether there's more of it, is up to you.
Yeah.
And
so you're self-authoring.
Right. And it requires attending to that and understanding it and not missing that you have the capability to do that. So for someone who's able to be good,
even a little bit, even right. even if, you know, to, I mean, and I've kind of made this point, though, probably imprecisely, that for anybody trying to make a prognostic judgment of a third personal, you know, mm-hmm. like, is this, how likely is this person to turn themselves around in time to graduate from this program? Like, it may be that the correct objective estimate for anyone else to give is like 2%. Mm-hmm. Because all I have to go on is their past behavior and their premises up to this point. And as far as I'm concerned, like, they are part of the furniture of the universe. And mm-hmm. I can only, you know, just project how things will go from here. But for that person from inside, mm-hmm. the probability may be very different because they know that they, you know, they can intend differently. They can make different choices. They can envision a different path, and they can put themselves on it in spite of all the inertia pushing them toward the failure path.
There's no, the question, what is the probability, is incoherent for you.
This is the imprecision.
Probability is a thing you can ask
right.
about something third personally, you know,
right.
what's the probability that this sign will fall again? You know, it fell a little bit while we were setting up. It has to do
mechanical
with how
process,
well that sure. thing holds. And what's the probability that one of these people will ask a question or something? But right. what's the probability that I'll do something?
I mean, I'm
in control of whether I do it. I can't this look at
point.
It as,
yeah.
you know.
This is my point. But, yeah. but I mean, you can still, you know, there are constraints upon mm-hmm. our agency at any given point in time based on what we've, you know,
right.
sort of developed.
What's
and done
the probability
today?
That I'll be able to do
yeah.
it?
So you can, yeah. And people do ask themselves those right. questions, and it's a really salient matter to people. Like, but can I get right. through the program at this point? Like, is that actually plausible?
Is it possible for me,
yeah.
et cetera? But those questions resolve down into smaller ones.
Yeah.
And when you get down to the smallest questions that are the units of it, at least for some of them, the answer is, will you do it? And
right.
so.
And so there's a really self-fulfilling mm-hmm. property to any assessments that we make about mm-hmm. what our life can hold or what we yeah. could be capable of.
And when we're down to those units, and if we identify them of what actually is possible to us if we choose, then
yeah.
nothing, the fundamental fact, I think, for them, the important fact is, well, we're able to choose.
Right.
And that we
and
have
that's irreducible.
This there for us.
Yeah.
And it can be really hard to tell what things, you know, we're able to choose and what we're not and which ones right. are complexes that include some part that we're able to choose. But the, insofar as it is open to our choice, it's not at all an issue of probability. It's an issue of decision. And insofar yeah. as it's something that's not wholly up to us, the difficulty is figuring out which things are things of decision, and they're not decisions
yeah.
that we'll make now, but make in the future, and how to disentangle those from the other things. But
yeah.
your being you makes the perspective on you just ineliminably different.
Yeah.
And I think also when you're talking about someone who you have assumed the responsibility for raising, the perspective is also ineliminably different, both from your perspective on yourself and from your perspective on a third person. And I would
yeah.
think that it's yet another thing when it's somebody who you've committed to in another way. There's a different perspective that we have on people who are our friends
yeah.
than we have on third person people who might become our friends. But there's a kind of
right.
And certainly I would think with a patient as well or a client.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So I think just returning to the agency point from it, this might be too far afield, but it feels very relevant, maybe just because I've been thinking about it a lot, that there's a kind of reciprocality between the selfishness, or I remember somewhere in her journals, Rand wrote about meta-selfishness, which really struck me at the time. I don't even know if I remember the meaning of it correctly as she intended it, but it keeps coming back, like this kind of implicit, like really kind of fundamental commitment to yourself and to figuring out, even if you don't know if selfishness is the right moral code, but like you're trying to figure it out because you want to figure out what's best for you and for your life. And like, you're still pro you on some really fundamental level versus you've come to view yourself as a means in effect versus you've come to see yourself in this third personal way where you're not an end, but you're conditional, your value is conditional upon some, for you know, satisfying some intrinsic standard or some external set of criteria that's, you know, that God or society or someone else constructed for you. And I find that when you're on that kind of premise, your agency becomes not a source of kind of power in the way you were just describing, but a threat.
So tell me more about this idea of a way of going wrong is coming to see yourself as a means.
I mean, I see this all the time. Like, I think in a certain way, anytime that someone is in what I've been calling the drill sergeant mode, you know, and kind of beating themselves up because they haven't hit a certain milestone or they haven't gotten, you know, like far enough in their career by a certain age, or, you know, ruminating on all their failures such that they can't kind of get themselves started to kind of advocate for their, you know, for the next goal pursuit that they might otherwise be acting toward. And they're as if trying to secure permission from some authority, and often it's sort of, it lives in their heads at this point as an adult, you know, from like their own inner drill sergeant critic, whatever you want to call it. You know, people often talk about like the inner critic, but they're trying to sort of get permission. They're trying to like satisfy some set of criteria such that then they can pursue their happiness.
So what's the means?
Well,
I'm just not hearing it in means and terms.
Yet. Yeah. And I don't know if that's actually the most precise way to describe it, but it's sort of like I am, my right to pursue my own ends depends on first satisfying whatever these other ends that someone else has for me. So like, as long as I'm a good enough son or a good enough student or a good enough citizen, I'm allowed to then, you know, pursue my own, but only insofar as I'm functioning as a good cog in this greater wheel.
Well, is it only insofar as it helps me to do this thing? Or is it only if I, like, in other words,
what do you mean?
I'm allowed to pursue my happiness only insofar as it makes me a better father or a better son.
Or
better
even citizen? After, because it's never, you never quite get so to I where earn, now you're allowed to.
I earn it, yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it's contingent upon being useful in some way is the way so that I sometimes
I see how the conditionality point applies to this. I'm not sure how the means and language. The reason the means and language struck me is interesting is because there's this famous formula in Kant, one of his two ways three ways of describing the moral law. And Kant, of course, is, you know, the objectivist supervillain, right? But I think there's often something really interesting in these formulations that is, if it's wrong, interestingly wrong and deeply wrong, and sometimes is right, or right understood one way and wrong understood another. You can't be being very opposed to something requires being
on a we get the anyway, disclaimer.
The formula is to never
treat yourself.
To treat humanity, whether in your own person or the person of another, as an end and never merely as a means.
Yeah.
And you might think about, you know, what things amount to treating humanity in yourself as a means.
Yeah. And I do think at least that's one flavor of the larger phenomenon that I'm describing, where
For Kant, treating yourself as your humanity as a means, I think, amounts to treating your reason, your ability to think, as for the sake of satisfying your desires.
Yeah, that's not what I mean, obviously. I mean treating your whole existence and your goal pursuits, your, you know, energy expenditure, your priorities, whatever, as a means to the satisfaction of some other standard that is non-you. And outside of you.
But even in the Kant case, I think there is something right about it.
I mean, it is, I guess, it kind of describes a form of rationalization wherein
you... Yeah, because if you take your desires as things that exist apart from your rationality and your thinking, they just came over you, right? And they're just there. And
well, and the same thing goes for desires based in guilt and
negative
emotion, right? Like, I have a desire to appease my mom so I don't have to feel bad anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Same kind of thing.
Whatever your list of desires, if you take them as sort of there on their own and not coming from your mind's authorship, if you think of the role of your reason as just serve them, just instrumentally, I think you are kind of treating who you are as a human being. And
I think that is the psychological mechanism whereby what I'm talking about gets actualized. Because really, it's through your own emotional mechanism that whatever the standard presiding over you that isn't your life gains potency over, right? It's you're, in effect, a servant to your own emotions and to whoever it is that's bullying you through your emotions.
In other words, whims, emotions that come from nowhere.
Yeah, whether it's the emotions that come from nowhere or emotions that come from, you know, guilt and pressures from some altruistic code or whatever, but it's through the emotions that it's emotions instantiate whatever external kind of motivators take priority over the needs of your own life.
Yeah, I mean, this has me thinking a thought that I just always am coming back to lately, that which is that so much of ethics and so much, I think, of psychology, so much of what's deep in them and getting them right in their pedagogy and so forth is kind of breaking through the means-end distinction as it's ordinarily held, where there are ends, that they come from somewhere. Either they just come from your feelings,
right,
or maybe reason just registers them, which is ultimately what I think Kant thinks happens with them, certainly what Plato thinks happens to them. And then the rest of reasoning is figuring out
how to get to
serve
those ends.
These ends, which ends, again, are just passively come over you, either by being registered by reason or by just being felt by the appetites,
right,
or by some other bit of you. But if you think of ends as themselves derived from reason,
right,
if you think about there's like a process of making them and working out the means to them as part of it, there's a kind of composition to a life. And the more we can spell out what that process is and what it looks like in different areas, I think the deeper kind of appreciation for what a life well lived is.
Yeah. And that's where, just to come back to the agency point, that's where your agency becomes the causal power whereby you can actually build a life, kind of build your way to those desired ends, and even just conceive of the ends and, kind of integrate it all together, as opposed to the ends are these kind of given, intrinsic, disconnected from me and my happiness and my needs kind of mandates. Mm-hmm. And the best case scenario is that I appease them so that they don't bother me anymore, that there's a kind of zero some game. Their itch is to scratch, in effect, and the best I can do is to eliminate the itch. And insofar as I have agency and I've failed to eliminate the itch, that actually only just that damns me more in the eyes of whatever real or metaphorical God has put those mandates there for me.
I mean, we're being very vague about what the alternative to the standard means ends picture is. I am
probably least, specify it.
And it is, I think, something that requires more thinking and more working out and more spelling out than I've done yet. But particularly when you're talking about viewing, I think the objectivist theory of values is the alternative to this. But
cashing that out, I mean, it's what I've been gesturing at.
Particularly cashing it out when put in this contrast, which isn't the way it's always put. We should maybe just mention a few places where this is written about, which are
causality versus duty.
So in Rand, causality versus duty, I think the chapters of Atlas Shrugged that are about the Nirvana premise, or it's a chapter they're Brother's Keepers, and Reardon's reflections on it. Galt's speech. I think the place where I've kind of worked through this most and what the view of valuing is chapter 3 of A Companion to Ayn Rand, which is on valuing, and a few other places. There's a new article by me in Routledge, Companion to Libertarianism, that talks a bit about this objectivism. But
I mean, and I've tried to gesture at it with my builder's mindset.
Mm-hmm. The idea of the builder's mindset, which
as an alternative to
you've been blocking about.
Which I have indeed, yes.
And also, I would just mention a couple of other things people might read, secondary sources. Daryl Wright's old audio course, Motivation by Love versus Fear, if it's available. Reasoning About Ends, also by Daryl Wright.
It's true.
In the first Ayn Rand Society Philosophical Studies books, it's got a name like
I think it's something like
Meta-Ethics, Virtue, and something. And Egoism, thanks. And then the other, I would say, Ankar Gatte's article on the motivation of the creators versus the second-handers in Robert Mayhew's book, Essays on Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead. So those are the things where I see
that alternative getting fleshed out.
But I think there's a need for a piece just on means and ends, kind of developing this idea.
Which perhaps we'll collaborate on one day. I think that idea has been floated.
Yeah, we've I don't quite know what it should say or how it should be structured yet.
Right.
But yeah, but
sorry,
I
we haven't written it yet. Or the other one. Yeah. Indeed.
Unconditionally love it, maybe. too awful upon. Okay. So let's bring it back to our topic of love. And we're not thinking that love should be conditional, because that's the wrong way to put it.
Right.
But it's too empiricist-y, you're trying to tick specific boxes.
Right.
But what's meant when it's called for to be unconditional is...
it's something about fundamentals, right?
Well,
it's
by fundamentals. I think it's a package deal of calling for it to be causeless, unearned, not on any particular basis. To be like God's alleged love for us, where he loves us, you know, loves the good and the wicked equally. And
clearly that's not what we endorse or mean.
So insofar as there's this thing wrong with unconditional, it's a call for that packaged with a rejection of loving someone on contingency or on credit.
Okay.
What's the alternative? What is real love understood widely enough to incorporate all the things that we're talking about?
Yeah.
And maybe make it more than love, because what you feel for a client or something isn't love,
regard.
But positive regard. What is positive regard? What is fellow feeling for human beings properly?
Yeah, I mean, I like, you know, as I mentioned, you know, love for the best within the person, but also like a fundamental positive regard, like a positive regard for the fundamental humanity in those that we encounter.
Because you're not just loving the best within someone.
No, you're loving them.
Loving them for it.
Exactly.
And what it is to love someone for something is to regard that thing as
fundamental to them.
Yeah, and important, and the basis for your relationship with them.
Right.
And it's not that you should love everybody, but you should have a positive relationship towards the human species, because what we are and what's important about human beings is what they can do. And
I think it's notable, like, you know, Rogers talked about how he's yet to meet a patient whom he absolutely loathes or can't find something to love. In effect,
have you been able to give him a run for his money?
I mean, not as much as I would have expected. You know, when I started out, I thought, I'm gonna have all sorts of, look at the people I encounter in the world. If, you know, my clients are anything like the sample set,
of
people.
You were so chipper.
Yeah, Greg has now apparently.
No, but you're saying when you started when you started out, were so jaded looking at the people around you.
I mean, okay. I went into the field because I had hopefulness for, you know, the overall
more bimodal
value. Sure. And I thought, like, there'd be bad people and there'd be mixed people and there'd be good people. But, like, you know, there was some distribution that I would encounter. But by and large, I've had a very easy time loving my clients, or at the very least, you know, liking and having basically kind of fundamentally positive regard for my clients. That's not always true. And I think this is the basis for your commentary. It's not always true of people I meet in the world. And I think that's partly because I approach them differently. Like, I've developed a certain stance toward people
really
who come to me for therapy.
You use the word love for your clients and then kind of took it back, but then didn't want to. And I think,
I don't want to.
And I think, it seems to me
because there
the
is
right
a love
word to use. But obviously you don't love your clients in the way you love your husband or your job
or my
children,
child,
but
right.
Your job is the relevant thing, because, you know, your clients are the people with whom you do your job.
Yeah. And I do love them in that regard.
And love is always love as something or in that way, in that relation.
Right.
And as clients, I mean, I think that I love my students.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean each and every one of them is important and irreplaceable to me.
Sure, in the same way as, again, a spouse.
What I think love is really is irreplaceability, but as a value. But they're having students like them is.
Yeah.
And each one
is an instantiation of that.
Yeah, and is irreplaceable in their way. They're not interchangeable.
Yeah.
Or fungible.
That's right.
Right. Insofar as you come to know them and have a...
That's right. Yeah.
I'm talking about when you're lecturing before a hall of a lot of people, but when you're...
Sure. When you have any sort of personal relationship with them. Yeah, what, there was a question I was answering with that comment that I feel like there was more to say about. Do you remember your question?
No.
That's too bad. Anyone in the audience want to bail us out? A good point. That was an intermediate question in there about, yeah, giving more. Yeah, I mean, but what? Oh, hi. We have a question in the studio.
So, my question regards how to deal with people who have a different view on this topic than oneself in real life. So if I meet someone who believes in unconditional love and practices it properly, there's a fundamental conflict. Because on the one hand, they will feel threatened by my view. They will feel like I pressure them to achieve certain standards because they misunderstand my rejection of unconditional love. And at the same time, I will end up being unsatisfied with the relationship because they will only give me unconditional love, which, you know, it's unfulfilling because it's not anything that I care about, that they love about me. And so should I just avoid those people or should I try to convert them and teach them better ways? Like both of them seem like bad options.
Interesting.
What's the proper approach?
Okay. So, I mean, I would wonder, like, what do you mean that they have a different view? Like, at what level do they have this different view? Is it like literally you at some point and what, yeah. And like, is it at some point you had a debate about the term unconditional love and they thought like, that's a really good thing to have in a relationship. And you thought, no, that's wrong. Cause that's causeless. And then you kind of landed on this as like a technical disagreement. Or is it like, they tell you routinely, like, it's not anything about you. It's just, you know, I feel behooved to, like, I don't care if you're on time to meet me. I don't care if you, like, it's not about anything you do. It's not about who you are. I just sort of, I'm with you because I feel it's right. Because that's terribly unromantic. You know, I don't, not to say that this isn't a romantic context necessarily. But like, how does it manifest that they disagree with you on this?
So it might be that I would refuse to say very generic things.
Like what?
I don't know, you're the best person in the world, something like that. You know, things that just seem like this so unpersonal and is just like, it seems to me like a stupid thing.
Yeah, I think lots of people don't like that.
Yeah.
Whether or not they would endorse the phrase unconditional positive regard, I think, you know, as many people as not don't love really generic compliments that are clearly empty. Right. So that's what I would be more concerned with is, you know, are the two of you on the same page and sort of communicating in a way where like your love for each other isn't empty and where it's anchored to, you know, visibility into specific qualities that you value.
So your love for each other supposes that there is love for each other. If somebody's thinking, you know, he should love me no matter what. And he's thinking, yeah, I don't, unless such and such, and you don't have it, then you don't love the person. And so now maybe the issue is that they expect you to love them or act like you love them sooner than you think you should, or it's reasonable to. Maybe you think like, yeah, there's something here. You know, I like
her.
But
I'm getting to know you.
But, you know, don't rush me.
And that's a really common negotiation in friendships, relationships, what have you, whether people are using those terms. Like, you know, people generally understand that there's such a thing as falling in and out of love and that not everyone's in love with everyone, right? And that there can be a kind of differential in, okay, like I am falling for you really fast, but you're kind of still taking your time. You know, you're still getting to know.
We're talking about romance, but I can imagine this kind of thing coming up with family relationships,
sure.
A brother or a sister or parents or someone who you've, you know, had in your life for a long time, like an old friend,
sure.
Who maybe you're less close with than they think they are with you. And in general, I would want to think about like, well, what is the basis of this relationship on my end? What am I in this for? Why do I want to be here? What do I like about this person? And to communicate that. And if that's not enough for them, if that's not what they want, then, you know,
then maybe you can't give them what they want. Yeah.
And if it is, then there's a basis for.
Yeah. But also, again, like, but if you do that in a really kind of reflective and introspective way, like, you're not just going to be making comments about, like, I like that you turned up to this, you know, gathering. Like, you're going to be able to articulate, I love how you light up when you're excited about things in your life. I love how you approach your work. I love how you approach our time together, right? Like, they'll be pretty fundamental things. And I think people can tell the difference between.
Yeah, it's, but notice the how you and the way, like, yeah. If it's, I love that you X, Y, and Z, and then you can put a bunch of abstractions. It's very easy not to feel seen.
No, it's the how.
And if it's, you know.
And you can fill that in, yeah, you know, with a lot of the particular. I mean,
but so, it's not just in the communication. It's how you think about it. If you think about it, front, like, what would you miss if the person was right? What is it that you look forward to when you look forward to seeing them? And sometimes it'll present itself to you as an abstraction. Well, she's so competent or whatever. But it's like,
but yeah, it's not going to end there.
There are plenty of competent people. What is it about her?
Yeah.
I don't just want to see anyone competent. And sometimes it'll occur to you as something super concrete, the way she smiles, the tone of her voice, the whatever.
But and like, that means a lot more to people than you're the best person in the world. Like, yeah. I think, like, part of the irony here is I don't think most people are craving the compliment of, I think you're the most amazing person alive, because that's meaningless and everyone knows it's meaningless. I think what they're craving are those much more specific. What's that? Did you say? Speak for yourself.
There's a contingent that wants to be told they're the
best people. Okay, well, there's someone for everything, as I like to say. But by and large, like, what people want to know are the specifics, I think. And that's what carries more emotional weight and has credibility.
What I think, you know, the ideal is so I was going to say, sometimes it'll present it to you as a concrete like this, but you have more purchase on it when you can say, like, well, what is it about her smile, or that, what does it mean? What does it stand for? How does it relate?
And connect them to the fundamentals. Yes, that's right. Yeah, I don't know if have you seen the movie When Harry Met Sally? There's I sometimes like references as a kind of cheap and superficial but relevant heuristic where at the very end, maybe I shouldn't give it away. Where there's
the movie's like 30 years old, right, or more.
That I manage not to spoil such plots for myself till I'm ready to. Anyway, the point is, there's a kind of listing out of, I love this, 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 and this about you. And it has a feel of a kind of authenticity to it that, it, like, even though the movie's not that deep or that philosophical and it stays at a pretty surface level, but there's a kind of a gestalt about it. It's like it comes together into, okay, there's a, you love this person as a person, and these are all the little facets and the little nuances that make this person who they are to you, and it suddenly becomes much more believable. And I think there's just something about that, like, is that conditional?
But here's the other side to that, because, all right, so picture a more realistic, like, a 1 degree less abstract presentation of what Jim Taggart wants, mm-hmm. right? Like, he says, I want to be loved just for me, not for anything I do or have or am or whatever, not because I did this or made that or was that, so that there's no content to him. Okay, what would somebody who actually felt that actually want? Would they be upset by if somebody said, well, the way you crinkle your nose and the way you wear your hat, the way, what's that?
The way you sip your tea.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Although, so think of that Frank Sinatra, I don't even remember.
It's Fred Astaire. I don't know who wrote it, but it's Fred Astaire. Yeah. Probably Irving Berlin.
There's a whole bunch of like little, the way you sip your tea, the way you wear your hat, the way you do all that, whatever. They can't take that away from all these details about the person. But like, no, we're not told what the details are, right? Like, there's something about the way you do this and something about, you know, the way you walk, Jim, and the way you talk and the lilt of your head and the way, like.
Yeah, but it would be BS. Words,
there's a whole bunch of stuff I love about you, but it
doesn't add up to anything.
Right. But what you think is like, there's something I see in the way you wear your hat.
And that's ideal, is if you can articulate that.
And you might not be able to say what it is abstractly, but.
But oftentimes, even when it's implicit, it's there. Like, you can mm-hmm. tell the difference between when it's there and when it's not. When I've had friends, exes, whoever, kind of tell me, you know, like, react to certain aspects of, like, how aggressively I managed to get last-minute tickets to a Broadway show, even though it was standing room only, and then ended up dancing in the back the whole time. And how awesome is it that we got these standing room tickets? I could just dance along to the show, you know. And then there were various, very specific ways the person reacted to me that contained within them a lot of identifications about my more basic character. for better or for worse.
Only on this podcast can you find presenters telling you what's lovable about them, reflecting on what they like.
That's their weird. Partners. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, the point is.
Yes, that is charming. But the issue is when you, I mean, part of what makes it a concrete and makes it love for a particular person and not the abstraction is the concreteness of it. And the concreteness of it goes all the way down. And if you look at Rand's characterization of this in Romantic Love, she talks about sense of life, and it's the, you know, the individual style of an individual soul, and it's kind of replaceable. And in that essay, Philosophy and Sense of Life, where she talks about it, you get kind of the other side of a presentation of personal relationships that is in the speech in Atlas Shrugged, Francisco's speech, characterized in a way that makes it seem, you know, much more abstract and generic. Right. And I think the more abstract and generic presentation works in the context of the novel because you have so much personality.
Because you've concretized it so extensively,
From the characters. But, so it needs that context to
and even then, it sort of takes cognitive work to put it together with that context.
But if you just take the sense of life issue, the individual style of an individual soul, you could feel like, yeah, well, that can be anything. It's something ineffable. You can never quite put it into words. And in some sense, you can't, because you can never put any experience all the way into words. It's always too detailed for words. But you can find things that essentialize, capture it. And the question is, are you responding to a particular, highly detailed, you know, with all the individual irrepeatable features of way of being a human being, way of doing what human beings do?
Yeah.
Or is it, you know, a kind of keep defaulting on that.
Right. And I think part of what's distinct to the perspective we're trying to articulate here is when you attend to people, or at least like people that you're getting to know, or people who are your clients or your students, or, you know, people that you're relating to in any kind of meaningful way, like, are you attending to the details of them from a perspective of a love for humanity? And that's like with Montessori's quote about the child who isn't there, and, you know, with Roger's examples of like kind of what he's seeing in his patients. Like, I think these are all cases of like you're seeing people from a very particular slant. You're not just kind of a completely neutral observer who just sort of is piling up these particulars for no, you know, with no particular kind of selectivity to it. And you're just kind of noticing stuff willy-nilly, but you're like learning about like, what is the essence of this person's, you know, humanity? Like, how does this person strive? How does this person grapple? How does this person love? And like, you're seeing it in the particulars, but you're attending to things with an eye toward integrating those details into a view of the person. And I think that that's conducive to, you know, to loving people more, all else being equal.
I do want to, and we're getting near where we should close. I do want to close by saying I think there's a real fundamental difference between the way you look at someone when you're looking on the one hand at a friend or a lover, or on the other at a child, a student, or a therapy client.
Sure.
In the latter kind of case, you really are looking at your role is to help them get better.
Yes.
To help them develop. And you're looking at them as almost a kind of work.
Yeah.
Something.
It's a very different vantage point.
You're looking at them. I mean, the therapy word that we don't use anymore is patient. Right, because you're not saying client to stress their agency. But there's patient in the philosophical sense of patient, someone that you're going to act on.
Yeah.
And there's both sides to that because you expect them to act too and to act back. And certainly, if you're loving them, you're loving them for what they can do back.
Yeah, but it's not reciprocal in the same way.
But there's still a – you're, in a sense, there for them.
Yeah.
You're there – you're trying
– there's an asymmetry.
Yeah. And
– doesn't or oughtn't exist in friendships and romances.
Love and friendship in the normal sense of them, and the sense where they provide the value that they uniquely provide to life, is where you're not looking to what somebody can be.
Right.
And you're not looking for what they are as a sign of what they can be and fostering the future in them. You're looking at the developed thing.
Yeah.
And that's what you are admiring and wanting. And there's always, because human beings are things that grow and develop. And if they're doing their life well, they're going to get better rather than worse. There's always the, you know, hope for and projecting and looking forward to the improvement. But nevertheless, it's almost all on what's there and what the future portends because of what's there. Whereas in the other cases, it's the promise for the future that's based on what's there, but the emphasis is different.
And I think, I mean,
that difference matters.
Yes, and I've thought about this a lot, but like the value you gain, the value you seek and you, that you gain from those two kinds of relationships is fundamentally different in a way that like, I think helps explain why therapists shouldn't be friends or lovers with their patients and why maybe the Gilmore Girls don't have the healthiest mother-daughter dynamic insofar as they're also best friends. This is all Greg's doing. I still love them for exactly the kind of dynamic that they have. Anyway, the point is, because it's a very fundamentally different stance and a fundamental way of relating to another human being, when you're in this position, in effect, of a nurturer, right? Of like what you gain from raising a child, from nurturing someone's, you know, agency in a therapeutic context, from educating them in a student context, whatever, is the kind of experience of cultivating these qualities of humanity in this particular person. And it is not the joy of connecting over shared values and the kind of the reciprocal exchange of it. The trade is very different, right? And sort of like what gaining value from that relationship depends on, speaking of conditions, is very different. Like for me to get, and here's the thing, there are patients or clients, whatever you want to call them, whom I fire for various reasons. So in effect, like, yeah, you could say that there are conditions upon the trade. Like there are contexts in which I'm no longer gaining what I need, which means that I know they're not going to be gaining what they need. Because as with every human relationship, it's win-win or lose-lose. But like if clients aren't actually engaging in the work for whatever reason, maybe it's my fault I haven't gotten them engaged, but like it's no longer a value to me. And that's very different from why I might break up with someone in a romantic context, because like they're not providing me with the kinds of, you know, social romantic needs that I want a romance to fulfill. You want, okay. Yeah. Yes. Hi.
Yeah.
Hi.
Someone joining us.
So my question, it's just a clarifying question.
Sure.
I feel like a lot of discussion has been about loving humanity. And when I ask myself, do I love humanity? I would be like, intuitive answer will be, yes, I do. But I don't quite understand what loving humanity really is. Hmm. Like, what is humanity actually?
It's a great question.
Yeah. And I just can't define it, more than just intuitive answer. So
Do you want to start? Or should I?
Yeah, I think you can think about a human being in the abstract. Think about the way that Rand will write, but a lot of writers, it's kind of gone out of fashion.
Man is a heroic
being. We'll talk about man. Man, there's a great, it's not particularly, but the title is great, collection of Aristotle's works called Aristotle on Man in the Universe. Well, what do you mean by man? A particular man, some man? Well, like, you know, what a human being is. Or the other kind of place where you get to see this is like, think about a nature video that talks about the, like, you know, the speckled finch spawns in the spring and it comes here and it says, which speckled finch? All of them, this one, some of them. Well, there's a speckled
finch. The platonic form of the speckled finch.
The way it does. But it's the form, the species.
Right.
But the species not considered as a group, but considered as an abstraction. Mm-hmm. So you're thinking about what a thing of this kind does when it's acting in the way that's characteristic and natural to and proper to a thing of this kind.
Yeah.
And so likewise, you can think of a human being or human beings like that. What does the human being do? Or what does man do? Or how does man live? Well, he lives by his mind and he's able to project and create values and he's able to form win-win relationships with other human beings and so forth. And that's what a human being does. And when I'm thinking about humanity, I'm thinking about that thing, that creature that lives that way, that human beings are able to live and that they live when they're doing it right. And
yeah.
and every particular human being to the extent that he realizes or approximates to that.
Yeah. And there's a kind of view of the human potential, I think, right, that's implied in that, like the natural, the normal, the healthy course of affairs for a human being, as for a finch of whatever sort, you know, is to sprout its wings and to go in search of what?
We're getting worms. People kind of riffing on the nature video view of man.
That's great. I'm sure better than I could, since I've viewed very few nature documentaries, as we know. I'm pretty selective in my love of organisms. I mostly just focus on the humans and kind of ignore them. Except, well, no, cats I'm a big fan of. Anyway, the point is, this is now departed from the point. But yeah, like when Rogers or when humanists, because there's a kind of, you know, humanist movement and perspective within, I guess, both philosophy and psychology that I think in some ways is kindred to objectivism, though not, you know, identical to it by any means, and is probably mixed in its own ways. But I think like the core sentiment within this humanist kind of perspective is a kind of a view of the human potential that's fundamentally positive, which isn't the same as saying like every human being is great or everybody's, you know, destined for virtue and greatness. Like, of course not, right? But especially to the extent that we see agency as a really fundamental part of human nature, like we allow for the fact that people won't always develop their faculties, that some people will go very wrong or will go in a bad way. But like, we love about this kind of organism that it has agency and that it can achieve incredible heights of, you know, creativity and innovation and deep love and feel deep joy and create meaning, right? Like, that's what we love when we say we love humanity. Does that make sense? Does that clarify?
Yeah, I guess it does, because I think I was thinking about there are good and bad things about humanity. And when you say love humanity, do you mean that you have to love both? Or I think it clarified that loving humanity is more like loving the human potential, and it's more like the ideals that...
Well, it also depends on whether you think the bad things are inherent and...
Or derivative, in a sense. Or like secondary to the fact that we have agency and that we're not sort of fated to go a certain way.
Yeah, but I mean, if you think that, you know, everybody has feet of clay and everybody has flaws and so forth, if you view the... I mean, I don't think there are good and bad things about human beings. I think human beings are all good. Now, there are good and bad things about particular human beings, but I think like humanity and human nature and what a human being is essentially is all good or else neutral. I don't think there's a bad to that, because I think all my values are directed to what's possible. And if there's something that it's impossible to be, like, you know, you never die and you never get sick and you never make a mistake or whatever.
Sure. Then there's nothing to comment about that.
You know, that's not possible. And so that's not something you could assess as good or bad. Good, I think, is doing what goodness for me is defined
relative
by achieving
to the nature of the organism,
the kind of life that we're capable of achieving. And so for me, that life is the standard of goodness. And, anything else is kind of inessential. It's like, to the extent that someone's bad, it's the extent to which they're not being a human. They're not living up to their humanity. That's how I think about it.
Which might seem harsher than wherever we started, but yeah, I think there's something I agree with in that elaboration.
Well, it could be all touchy-feely. And, you know.
God forbid.
Something I mean, when you know, this is an objectivism podcast. Recall this is the Mike Wallace interview, I think it was. One of them, when she was asked about this high view of man and so forth, she said, what about somebody who, you know,
they're not a man,
is such and such, and, you know, and they want to be loved? And her response was, well, they certainly don't deserve it.
Yeah.
So there is a kind of...
different emphasis.
But there is a kind of judgmental quality to love. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're loving somebody, now not in the potential way if you love a children, you know, or whatever. There's a judgment involved. And it's a judgment that you're good. And you're good in a particular way that resonates with what I personally care about.
And I think that's partly like that's also why it's contextual.
And
like,
not everyone's
you don't
that
love
good.
Someone qua partner the same way you might love them as a therapy client or as a kid. Right. And so
but even there,
the judgments are different depending on the context of the relationship.
Even there, as a therapy client, they're a good therapy client if you love them as a client. You don't love all your clients equally in the same way. Or you love the challenge of it, right? For a kid, when they're young enough and when you start with them, you do love them all, and it doesn't involve that kind of judgment. You would love whoever they were, but precisely because there you're loving them in this way that's focused on the potential, and then you focus on the good bits. But, you know. But it's not a.
Yeah. Like, but it's also like because the goodness is so writ large in a child. Like it's not hard to see it. And that's part of what I was talking about. Like not just in the potential, but in just like children by and large are really well meaning and they're really innocently selfish about what they're interested in and what they pursue and they're sincere. Right. And like they, in fact, exemplify a bunch of the qualities that I think, you know, make humans lovable.
Yeah. But it's your. Like loving an adult or loving in the way where you love a peer is judgmental. Loving a child for potential is judgmental of the fact that humanity is good, but it's not a judgment of the child. And what it is a kind of connoisseurship within the child of what's good about, of what's best in them and so forth that you're attending to or trying to attend to and trying to find and make sure that you're not doing it in too parochial a way so that what's best in them is the ways in which they happen to share your interest or something rather than the more fundamental ones. But it's you're committing to the particular child and investing in the particular child, not because of some way you've judged them to be better than other children, but precisely for the lack of that, because, you know, in a sense, they could be anyone, but they're a human being and they're your human being.
Yeah. And but just to like, but to cash this out, the way that I think it's similar in a child and an adult to be on this premise that like love is in terms of fundamentals and love is organismic rather than like instrumental or whatever, like in relationships, this will often come up. And in parent-child relationships, this will come up. Like, well, I love you, but I sure would love you more if you were to, like, get a paying job. Right? Like where with a kid, especially, you know, when parents are, like, gunning for the kid to become a doctor or a lawyer and the kid feels like, okay, well, I'm going to lose my parents' love if I decide to go and try my hand at music or art or, you know, something they consider really risky or really unattractive. Like, there's something deeply wrong with that. And it's not because at that point the parent is being too judgmental. It's because they're judging on these kinds of superficial norms that are largely particular to them rather than valuing the child's fundamental agency, right? Which includes their right and their freedom to go a different way than a parent might and to explore paths that aren't conventional and to struggle in their own ways. It's the same thing sometimes in relationships where, like, you know, a partner gets really annoyed with their spouse whenever the spouse, you know, has a bad day at work or doesn't bring in what, you know, you name, like, because the spouse is, I mean, the same thing, like their job isn't as high paying as the person hoped and that the person's kind of disappointed in them or disappointed that they didn't get into a certain program when they were applying to it. Like, then what kind of a love is that? Like, it's a love that's sort of instrumental and where, again, like the person is at least functioning a bit as a means. Like, well, I loved you for the convenience of being able to be married to someone rich.
You could be disappointed in someone.
Sure.
And it wouldn't be a mistake to be disappointed
Correct.
In someone.
And it wouldn't be based on some particular contingency like that.
You can have that disappointment in either kind of love relationship.
Yes.
Right? So you could marry someone and you love them and so forth and they do something and you're really disappointed in them.
Absolutely.
And
not because at a characterological level.
Parochial desire, but they really, you know.
They let you down at a fundamental level of like, I thought this person was trustworthy and they're not. Or I thought this person was really a trier and now I'm kind of seeing that they give up at the first
or they did in this occasion because it's not like
and I could be disappointed on this occasion but that probably wouldn't yet you know be a demerit on my love.
Let's think this through a little more in both kind of cases because there's the kind of I was wrong about him scenario. But let's not
he's
changed or was threatening to change or did something that's inconsistent with him being, you know, who I thought he was. And I don't think I was wrong about him all along, but this certainly isn't what I was expecting. And I am disappointed. Right. So if you, part of what it is to love someone and love someone based on who they've been and who you are with them is you don't just say, well, you know, I'm out, right? You did something this one time differently. If you really think I was wrong about him the whole time, then you do say that. But
it should
like,
take a lot.
I really want, I know what's good about you. I know you don't have to be this. You're better than this. Why are you being this way? Why aren't you living up? You know, like you feel that. And there's a question of how you deal with it and how you, but you're invested in them being what you know they are or have been or can be.
Yeah.
Now think about it with the child. A child can grow up in a way that's a real disappointment to their parents.
Sure.
And not just because the parents have, you know, messed up inappropriate standards. The person becomes a criminal and
Hitler in the extreme case.
But forget
that.
I mean,
but
like,
even in, more mundane
cases. At some point,
like,
maybe you have to
give
up
to launch,
on the child.
And there's just no hope.
But you should really be. And it is their fault that they did it. And it's not, not like, oh, you know, I had a, you know, my vision of life was that he has to be. XYZ and he's not, he's, you know, what's going on there? Well, there, I think you similarly, the disappointment is based on something real that you loved, but here it wasn't fully the actuality.
Yeah.
It was the potentiality for what he can be. And you're knowing that as a human being, one, that's the general potentiality for childhood, he can be so much more than this. And two, since it's not like you go from infant to like, 25-year-old failure to launch, like all the things that were better within his life where he could have, you know, you were, you think of that
you're
time
grieving
in third grade
the non-realization of all those things.
Yeah, and you're grieving it, but also you're super focused on the potential to achieve. And think about like a very sad case for a parent where like, I don't think my kid will ever amount to much, but he can be better than this. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think of like, I'm thinking of someone who, you know, I'm not thinking of a particular person, but imagine a parent who's, you know, now elderly and their kid's in middle age and is in a very, very bad spot in life up to now, but they're hoping for them to rise higher that maybe they'll never be what I, you know, fully hope, but I hope he'll, you know, get his life together
to a better place. He'll
have a little bit of happiness. You're even in the worst kind of case of it, there's that real commitment to the generic human potential that you've always had the commitment to in this person, and two, all the better bits of them that you've seen, which are going to have real, particular, concrete content. And that also is, I think, what that person should have for themselves if they're trying to improve their life, right? And
and that's the way in which we would do well to regard ourselves in, you know, something like the way that a parent healthily might regard us.
So I want to end on some more pleasant note than the worst case scenario.
Indeed.
Of like the person is evil, but it's like you love them despite great disappointment.
Please.
It's such a happy topic in general to end on the lowest above.
so well, what you got?
I'll say one thing. We talked about the thing that's in common between parental, teacherly, and therapeutic kinds of regards for someone. And on the one hand, and on the other side, the kind of love you have for a peer, which could include, you know, romantic love in the case of a romantic relationship or just a really close friend.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I alluded to earlier in the case of parenting is that that you expect there to be tensions and difficulties as the kid gets older. And there's a,
I think I see where this is going.
There's a movement from the one category to the other. Mm-hmm. Maybe it can never fully happen in the parents. I think in the case of, you know, older and younger friends and teachers or students, it can. And I've had two really good experiences in my life, both of which were attended with some difficulties at times, of moving from a
mentoring relationship,
student teacher kind of relationship to
one of friends and equals,
being really close friends.
Yeah.
And I've had it, you know, from different directions.
Yes.
So one of them was with Alan Gotthelf, who, for whom my son is named and with whom I did a lot of work and was a student of.
Mm-hmm. You're so cute.
Oh, you're so playing down by trying to end on a nice touching note.
I'm not playing anything you're down. So, I think I'm taking it well, considering how embarrassing it is.
And the other is with present company.
Yes, as we've discussed on many occasions. Yes,
but
our
not in public
rocky either. Transition from, you know, from teacher.
Never quite teacher.
Sure, mentor, mentee, which I know you hate that word. To well, friends.
Protege is such a better word. Okay. Anyway, thank you for being such a good friend.
Likewise, back at you.
And thank you, dear viewers. We'll probably be next with you on the 30th. Yaron Brook is going to be in town for an event, a discussion with Mika Watson on Ayn Rand versus C.S. Lewis, different views of 20th century authoritarianism. That will be, I believe, live streamed on this channel in the evening of the 30th. But Yaron's going to be with us during the day, too, and we expect to do a program with him in the afternoon where we're kind of sorting out the details of what the topic will be. So we'll probably see you next in that context. Next week is Thanksgiving and the university is closed, so we won't be here. But
it's true.
How have I been ending? Good night and have a pleasant tomorrow. But that's too silly.
Wow.
Wishing you all best premises, and I'll see you in a couple of weeks.
This has been Choose Your Issues, the podcast of the Objectivism Program of the Salem Center, recorded live in the McCombs School of Business at the University of Texas, Austin. Opinions expressed herein are those of the speakers and do not reflect the views of the university or any of its component units.